Brandon Garrett is one of our fine scholars and professors who teaches post-conviction remedies, civil rights litigation, and civil procedure. He got his BA at Yale University and his law degree from Columbia, where he was on the Law Review and was a Kent scholar. He also served for the Honorable Pierre Laval on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And then he worked several years in practice for the firm of Cochran, Neufeld, and Scheck. Neufeld gave a wonderful talk here last week, in which he worked on DNA exoneration cases, wrongful conviction cases, and police brutality. He also worked at Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman, doing mass tort cases and civil rights cases. He's also written several articles on equal protection and wrongful convictions, as well as two on racial profiling in the Columbia Human Rights Law Review. He wrote Remedying Racial Profiling, the topic of today, and in the Columbia Law Review, one called Standing While Black. Professor Garrett.
Hi, thanks for having me here. I'll stand since there aren't really enough chairs. If you want to sit down too.
No.
I was planning on standing anyway.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of my time in New York. I'm new to Virginia. I just moved here to start teaching in the fall, working on police brutality cases. And in law school, I worked on a class action case involving racial profiling and allegations of racial profiling. And then working at the firm with Johnny Cochran at its masthead, we received a lot of calls about police brutality cases. And not uncoincidentally, most of those cases involved race. And so I've done some writing, and this is sort of a modest return to a project of mine 5 years ago called Remedying Racial Profiling. And what I want to do is look back 10 years to when the movement to end racial profiling really started to take off, talk about why that happened, how the movement changed, how it began to focus more on systemic and statistical evidence that police overuse race, and then talk about how that movement is faring today after 9/11, and I want to argue that there's some surprises to how the racial profiling story has changed and how the movement has changed. I want to argue to today also that racial profiling is neither about race nor about profiling, and that the words racial profiling can only be understood in context. I don't think that the law either sheds much light on what racial profiling means. And I'll argue that the law is often counterproductive, and what has become much more productive is ways that the community and police have joined together to define what racial profiling means in the context of the problems that their community faces and the kinds of police tactics that seem to work. Now, I want to start sort of back 10 years ago when the racial profiling movement took off. And I want to start with a story about a case that I worked on, an individual case. And I'm going to keep coming back to this case and to the group of police officers that the case involved.
Yeah. Tom, what are you finding over there?
Roast beef.
Respectfully, I tell
do you want food?
I just got a plate.
I was waiting for a plate. Kate's bringing a plate.
Oh, that's okay.
I just want to make sure you have food.
Do you mind the cheese?
No.
Okay.
I didn't want you not to have food.
How you doing?
Good. How's it going?
Congratulations, Archie. Managing board.
Well, thank you, sir.
Excellent.
I thought you'd be impressed.
Busy man.
Sure.
It's okay, so up here, that's fine. You'll have plenty to drink, you know?
I had already one, so I did.
Do you mind calling people when you get the Q&A?
No.
Okay.
Awesome. Maybe I'll call them during my talk.
All right, should we start?
Sure, let's start. Am I supposed to stand? So it doesn't matter.
Oh, however you want. Completely.
We just don't
kind of stand. Right.
Okay.
So we never hear the story. We never
Okay, why don't we get started? Thank you for coming. I'm Kim Ford Mazrui, Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Law. And I'd like to thank Jen Shen and Kate Kockendorfer for helping arrange this talk as part of our resident faculty speaker series. And I'm pleased to introduce Professor Brandon Garrett today to talk about remedying racial profiling. A quick word about the center. If you're not on the sign-up sheet, I'm going to pass this around. All this will do is mean that you'll get email announcements periodically about events going on, but you needn't sign up, but I will pass it around. And speaking of which, stay tuned for in a couple of weeks, maybe March 28th, but you'll get an announcement, or go to the events calendar, and race and law events are separately, are categorized that way, so they should be easy to find. Adrian Davis, who's going to teach a two-week short course on slavery, is going to give a talk on slavery and sexuality. And then in mid-March, I'm forgetting exactly, but stay tuned, John Monahan on our faculty is going to give a talk about race as a factor in predicting dangerousness. So those are a few things coming up. Oh, and we have a panel at the Public Service Conference on the racial and economic implications of Katrina. Okay, but enough about the future. Let's get to today. Brandon Garrett is one of our fine scholars and professors who teaches post-conviction remedies, civil rights litigation, and civil procedure. He got his BA at Yale University and his law degree from Columbia, where he was on the Law Review and was a Kent scholar. He also served for the Honorable Pierre Laval.
Laval
on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And then he worked several years in practice for the firm of Cochran, Neufeld, and Scheck. Neufeld gave a wonderful talk here last week, in which he worked on DNA exoneration cases, wrongful conviction cases, and police brutality. He also worked at Beldoc, Levine, and Hoffman, doing mass tort cases and civil rights cases. He's also written several articles on equal protection and wrongful convictions, as well as two on racial profiling in the Columbia Human Rights Law Review. He wrote Remedying Racial Profiling, the topic of today, and in the Columbia Law Review, one called Standing While Black. Professor Garrett.
Hi. thanks for having me here.
I'll stand since there aren't really enough chairs. If you want to sit down too.
No. I was planning on standing anyway.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of my time in New York. I'm new to Virginia. I just moved here to start teaching in the fall, working on police brutality cases. And in law school, I worked on a class action case involving racial profiling and allegations of racial profiling. And then working at the firm with Johnny Cochran at its masthead, we received a lot of calls about police brutality cases. And not uncoincidentally, most of those cases involved race. And so I've done some writing, and this is sort of a modest return to a project of mine 5 years ago called Remedying Racial Profiling. And what I want to do is look back 10 years to when the movement to end racial profiling really started to take off, talk about why that happened, how the movement changed, how it began to focus more on systemic and statistical evidence that police overuse race, and then talk about how that movement is faring today after 9/11. And I want to argue that there's some surprises to how the racial profiling story has changed and how the movement has changed. I want to argue to you today also that racial profiling is neither about race nor about profiling, and that the words racial profiling can only be understood in context. I don't think that the law either sheds much light on what racial profiling means. And I'll argue that the law is often counterproductive, and what has become much more productive is ways that the community and police have joined together to define what racial profiling means in the context of the problems that their community faces and the kinds of police tactics that seem to work. Now, I want to start sort of back 10 years ago when the racial profiling movement took off, and I want to start with a story about a case that I worked on, an individual case. And I'm going to keep coming back to this case and to the group of police officers that the case involved, and sort of follow that over the last 10 years. And this case is the case of Dante Johnson. He was a 16-year-old African-American kid growing up in the Bronx. He lived near the Cross Bronx Expressway. And he encountered some police officers first in January or so of 1999, a little less than 10 years ago, 7 years ago. And in that particular encounter, there was some accusation that he had stolen $10 from a homeless person. The police brought him into the police station. He was kept there until 4 in the morning. He's finally released because the homeless person was making it up and wanted shelter. Anyway, so he had this traumatic encounter. He gets home late. His mother was worried about him. He's afraid of the police in the Bronx. Now, come May 1999, something has changed in the Bronx. In the neighborhood right near where he lived, Amadou Diallo was shot. The 41 shots, a sensational case that captured the attention of everyone around the city. This is also around the time that Abner Louima was brutalized in the precinct in Brooklyn. This is just a year after the New Jersey Turnpike shooting, which also captured national attention, where these four young kids on their way to a basketball tournament are shot on the turnpike by police officers who stopped them based on a practice of pretextual stops. There was no crime that they were violating. Their car stopped. The police say that it seemed like it was backing into them, and then they spray bullets into this car. The four kids live, but are they're never going to play basketball again. So all of this is in the background. And the particular unit of police officers in New York that were involved in the Amadou Diallo shooting was a very aggressive unit of officers called the Street Crimes Unit. It was about 300 officers. And they were tasked with some of the most dangerous work in the city and one of the most difficult assignments that any police officer could have. They were tasked with going around the city and trying to find guns. And their method of operating, their MO, was the same. They would just go up to people and do stop and frisks to look for those guns. As I'll mention later, you need reasonable suspicion for a stop and frisk. It's not a full search. They're patting people, trying to find. So they're looking for bulky objects. The neighborhoods where they regularly police are in what they called high crime neighborhoods, also high minority neighborhoods in New York. So they tend to be deployed in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens and upper Manhattan, not lower Manhattan. They have a slogan, "We own the night." They wear plain clothes. They drive in unmarked vehicles. And they operate off hours a lot of the time at night in darkness. It was considered very prestigious to get assigned to the street crimes unit. So officers who were very gung-ho and really wanted to show that they were good would try to get into this unit. And so one of the advantages of being this unit, aside from the prestige associated with it, and aside from it being a pet project of the police commissioner, was that you would get a lot of arrests. They were very active. They called themselves proactive. And this 300 police officer group was doing upwards of 60,000 stops a year. So they're doing a lot of stops. They're stopping a lot of people. They're looking for guns. So in May 1999, a group of these street crimes officers in one of these unmarked squad cars pulls up in a housing project in the Bronx. Dante Johnson is walking there with his friend Kevin. They're coming back from basketball. They're heading home. It's a little late. It's, dark out. It's a little after 10. But it's the summer, so a lot of people are kind of milling around outside and talking. They're a little bit away from the group because they're heading out of the project and toward Dante's heading home. Kevin lives someplace else. So the police officers slowly pull into this project, and everyone there knows it's an unmarked street crimes unit car because, it's like a big Chevy. And the street crimes unit is no stranger to any of the neighborhoods nearby. They're there every night, right? They own the night. They've been stopping everyone for a long time. And this is also after Amadou Diallo's shooting, just a couple months afterwards. And so people sort of start to kind of get off the sidewalk and go back into the lobby of these projects. Dante and Kevin don't really notice anything. They just kind of keep walking home. They're just talking and walking. And they're dressed, they're wearing baggy jeans, they're wearing sweatshirts. So because they're sort of separate from the group, police officers pull up to them. They're near the sidewalk. It was easy to pull up to them. They were kind of the first kids there. And one of the police officers just kind of yells out the window, "Freeze." They figure they're the street crimes. We don't even need to get out of our car yet. We just tell them to freeze. And that's it. And they start kind of picking up the pace to get away. And Dante is at this point scared. He knows these are cops. He remembers what happened to him a couple months earlier, and he spent all night in this police station over a homeless guy saying he owed him $10. And so he starts walking faster. So two of the officers get out of the car and say, "Freeze, stop, police." They both start running. Dante's a faster runner. Both of them are pretty athletic. Two of the police officers actually start to catch up with Kevin. He gives up. He kind of stops. Dante keeps running. Now, these police officers seem dead set on stopping both of these kids. When they stop Kevin, they start to search him. They pat him down. They don't find anything. So they're just kind of staying with him. Officer Conway, who's driving this cruiser, he didn't feel like getting out. And in fact, he starts driving after Dante Johnson. He pulls into the project, turns around, starts chasing Conway. There's an overpass over the Cross Bronx Expressway. That Dante's running over the overpass. And his mom's house is just two blocks away on the other side of this overpass. And so he's making his way over the overpass. And meanwhile, the officer is turning around. His squad car hasn't caught up with him yet. And he sees in the back, the officer is chasing him. He runs up the street. He's running on the sidewalk. The officer starts chasing him against traffic up this hill. So pretty wild driving, right? This is like a cop show. It's a one-way street. Cops driving the wrong way. It's a hill. Who knows who's coming over the hill? He's trying to reach out of his window to grab Dante Johnson out of his moving car. Dante Johnson's smart. He runs on the other side of the parked cars, so the police officer can't do that anymore. But then there's an obstruction on the sidewalk for some construction. He has to run back into the street again. And right there, the police cruiser is basically stopped. The police officer grabs him. And this is, 50 feet or so from his house. He's almost home. Somehow, there's Dante trying to pull away. He's quite scared at this point. He's been running away. Now this police officer is just grabbing him. And the gun goes off. The police officer says that he doesn't know how the gun got off. He claims that it was in his holster. but that he had taken it out of his holster while he was driving. Somehow the gun is next to him. Somehow it goes off. Somehow the gun next to him while he's sitting down fires at an angle that it goes basically straight through Dante Johnson's body. You know, he's on the ground in a pool of blood, but he needs 6 months of surgeries just to walk again and be able to digest again. You know, he's never going to be a basketball player again. And so he's, you know, in the hospital on traction for months and months and months, and, you know, more than a year of rehabilitation after that. So Dante Johnson lives, unlike Amadou Diallo, a single shot, but horrible shooting. What happened in the minutes after the shooting is also interesting in terms of police practices and what gets used to justify searches and use of force. So a lieutenant arrives on the scene, and the lieutenant is sort of the cleanup squad. This is the same lieutenant that showed up on the scene in the Amadou Diallo case and sort of shuffles all the police officers involved into a squad car, all sitting together, takes them to the hospital where they can be treated for their injuries. After they ride together to the hospital, where of course they don't speak to each other or get their stories straight, they're then taken to the precinct. While the officers are being taken away from the scene so no one can talk to them, arrests are processed. An arrest for Kevin and for Dante Johnson. They're both arrested. Dante Johnson, of course, is bleeding and taken to the hospital, but arrest is processed for him. An arrest for robbery and for possessing a weapon. Now, the problem was that neither of them was seen robbing anyone, and, you know, they frisked Kevin. He didn't have a gun. They frisked Dante Johnson on the ground bleeding. He doesn't have a gun. So they need a gun. Because after all, the purpose of the street crimes unit is to find guns. It would jibe with their purpose if these turned out to be kids that had guns. Later on, the justification for the initial chase is that the reason why they suspected these two kids wasn't just that they were available and they were on the sidewalk, but that they made a furtive gesture like this. Now, they very well probably did pull up their baggy jeans before they started to run so that their pants wouldn't fall down. But they claimed that they saw a bulge, not like a wallet, but more like a gun bulge, and that they knew what a gun bulge was because they've been stopping kids, you know, for months. And they saw a furtive gesture towards a bulge. That was what made them think these kids were suspicious. So they now do a canvas of the whole area where Dante Johnson, the entire path that he followed, all the streets are blocked off, and they do a canvas. Because the idea is that both of them had guns and they threw them off, you know, to the side, into the weeds, something like that. Now, I guess the surprising thing is that no one planted a gun, right? No gun was found. They did keep crowds away. Initially they said, well, maybe someone in a crowd, you know, came by and took the gun. But no gun is found. There is then press about this, like you'd expect. Early that morning, a shooting team is convened in the police department to review what happened. And Giuliani, the mayor at the time, Howard Safer, the police chief at the time, say some additional things to justify what happened. They explain that these kids had criminal records, although they were sealed juvenile records. They disclosed that. They should have been at home with their parents. And on top of that, these police officers were following up on a robbery pattern at that particular housing project, that they had heard a call about a robbery conducted by two young black men, that there had been a pattern in the neighborhood, that these kids matched a profile of a particular crime committed by two young black kids. Sort of the next thing that happens is that there's a criminal prosecution brought against Officer Conway. Turns out the prosecutor does an investigation. There was no such radio call. That was a makeup. There were crime patterns involving robberies in that part of the Bronx. Like you'd imagine, there were many patterns involving robberies, some of which even involved two people, but there was no particular one involving two young kids, even in that housing project. And there was certainly no call that went out, because these calls are taped, the afternoon before that shooting. Officer Conway is tried, and what does he get? He gets a $1,000 fine and 150 hours of community service for the shooting. He's convicted of negligent manslaughter. you know, highly unusually, actually, for a police officer to get convicted of anything for shooting someone. Here, I think what helped with the negligence was that, you know, he was not that he had no basis for chasing these kids in the first place or for stopping them in the first place, but more that he had his gun unholstered, which is contrary to regulations while you're driving. He was driving against traffic. You know, sort of the traffic rules and the gun handling really what were responsible for the criminal conviction, and not and apparently the jury didn't buy the ballistics that the gun had to be held like this for Dante to be shot at that angle from someone who was sitting down in the car. You know, you see the ballistics and the gun had to be like that. So I got involved in this case in a civil suit that was filed, and it was filed, you know, it was filed in 1999, not long after the shooting. You know, I started to work on it in 2002 or so. And civil suit doesn't, apparently it's now settled as of 2006. So this lawsuit drags on over 6-7 years. It's in state court, there's discovery, depositions, lasts forever. You know, the amount of the settlement is confidential. But, you know, no particular long-term change came out of this case. You know, there were protests at the time. The lawsuit took much longer than any protest could be maintained. One of the officers was disciplined because of it in this criminal case. The lieutenant, no discipline. Disciplinary charges were actually, our law firm made a request that this lieutenant, the cleanup lieutenant who filed these, who approved these arrests, that these false arrests for the robbery and for having a gun, we recommended that the auditing group in the police department investigate that. They found no wrongdoing. Certainly no change in what the street crimes unit was doing every day came out of this case. So, you know, Dante Johnson did finally get some compensation, but in other ways, you know, the case, as horrible as it is very unsatisfying. So a show of hands real quick. How many of you think that story that I just told of what happened to Dante Johnson, that incident, how many of you think that's a racial profiling incident? So I think that seems like a majority. And certainly, I think it's fair to say that race permeated that encounter, like it does many encounters, certainly many, if not all, encounters between, you know, young black men and the police in the Bronx. But there was a lot that went into that encounter, right? Dante Johnson had this previous encounter with the police that made him afraid. And he knew about the Diallo shooting. He knew about the street crimes unit, knew what they were doing, and knew probably that, you know, they wanted to stop him, frisk him, maybe arrest him. He'd been smoking marijuana earlier that day, so he was guilty, he felt guilty and was worried that they would smell that or something like that. But there were other issues aside from race, or that linked to race. They're the policies of the street crimes unit. You know, this encounter wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been this very aggressive unit of police officers that were going out looking for people to stop to see if they had guns. Right, these were proactive police officers. There was no robbery call. They were driving around these neighborhoods in the Bronx, looking for kids to stop, looking for guns. So, and what went wrong? You know, clearly, Officer Conway and his colleagues in the squad car stopped these kids in part because of where they were, what they were wearing, and that they were black. On the other hand, there's no question that they seem to have really believed that there was a reason to stop them and that they had guns. You know, when we asked them in the civil case, and I don't think they were lying. They said that they thought these kids had guns, and on top of that, they stop a lot of kids, and they always think that they have guns. They don't always have guns. You know, we asked them, you know, how much of the time, how often do you arrest kids? On the other hand, they really did do a lot of arrests. You know, if you ask them, and there's documentation of this, how many arrests do you do every month? They do a fair number of arrests every month. And, you know, they were doing things, especially Conway, driving like a maniac, you know, up a one-way street, trying to grab the kid. You know, he was risking his own life with these bizarre heroics, you know, deadly heroics, but he wouldn't have done that if he didn't think that there was something serious to be done. You know, clearly he wasn't trained. Clearly he was reckless and maybe unbalanced. You know, maybe not the kind of person the police officer should have hired. But in his own head at the time, he thought he was doing what a police officer was supposed to do. He thought that this was a potential criminal. This is someone who has a gun. This is someone I need to stop. So I want to link that case, and I already have a little bit already, to the national movement that starts to grow around racial profiling and starts to help define what racial profiling means. You know, this case is just one of many, like the Louima case, like the Diallo case, like the New Jersey Turnpike case, that all starts to grab national attention. You know, Al Sharpton starts convening a series of protests about all these shootings in New York and starts to become quite organized. And one question is, why does this start to happen then, you know, 1998, 1999? You know, race has always been salient, if not the most salient, characteristic of our criminal justice system. You know, it's nothing new to 1999 that, you know, although whites may use more drugs than blacks and commit more violent crimes, that are, you know, if they're overwhelmingly incarcerated and prosecute blacks, you know, disproportionate sentencing for minorities. You know, blacks fill 40% of our prisons. One in three black males likely to go to prison. You know, there's just statistic after statistic. Why all of a sudden was there this concern about, you know, not the prosecution, not sentences, but stopping people on the streets and in their cars, you know, driving while black, or walking while black, or Bob Herbert talked about in the case that I'll mention later, and just breathing while black. In a way, you know, maybe Dante Johnson and his friend were just, they were just walking, they were just breathing, they were just being there. So there's this, somehow, where there are so many features of our criminal justice system that are affected by race, somehow this particular slice of the system, these initial encounters with police and minorities, traffic stops, stops on the street, become something that people are outraged about. So part of it is these dramatic individual stories, these highly these shootings, you know, these incidents of police brutality. But there have been, you know, every few years, serious police shootings that are improper shootings in cities around the country. There had been before dramatic instances of, you know, police brutality, of shootings that had gone wrong. So why is it that those shootings became linked to thinking that these shootings happened because police are stopping, you know, young black men improperly? And that if they hadn't been doing this larger thing, these shootings wouldn't have happened. So somehow these individual instances of police force, like the Dante Johnson incident, become linked to an idea that there's a larger problem. Part of that seemed to be the emergence in the late 90s of statistical evidence for the first time about race and what police are doing every day. And part of this came out of, you know, one of the first sets of data came out of a settlement in Maryland where it was highway stops, and the police agreed to collect data to study whether there was a problem. And the data quickly showed that there was great disparity. New Jersey was another kind of locus for this early emergence of data about what police are doing every day. You know, in New Jersey, in the year before this Turnpike shooting, there had been a criminal case where someone had requested data. They were alleging that, well, you know, you should suppress the drugs in my case because the police stopped me only because I was black. They ended up getting in discovery, sort of by happenstance, documents showing that the police had actually hid data that, in fact, the New Jersey State Police were stopping dramatically more black motorists than white motorists. And it led to an admission by the state of New Jersey that, yes, we've been engaging in overuse of race, we've been racial profiling. So that larger statistical evidence was in the background a year later when the New Jersey Turnpike shooting occurs. And that's the connection where they say that, you know, this wasn't just a couple of bad cops that hastily fired their guns at these kids in a van for no reason. These are cops that in the aggregate, over time, are stopping disproportionate percentages of blacks. This wasn't an accident. This is a larger practice. This is then a profile that the police are following. These police are looking for blacks, they're targeting them, and that kind of targeting doesn't just lead to violence in a few cases, but it leads to injustice across the board for these thousands and thousands of others that are stopped. You know, nothing violent happens, but they're given tickets, they're inconvenienced. They have these, you know, humiliating instances where they're stopped and frisked, whatever it is. In New York, there was then done a study sort of taking this model that we need to try to get statistics on this and find out if these individual cases are part of a larger problem. So after Diallo, after Dante Johnson shooting, after Louima, the Attorney General's office, Elliot Spitzer, comes in and does a study collecting all these handwritten forms that the street crimes unit are supposed to fill out whenever they do a stop. Now, we know that they don't always fill them out, but they particularly fill them out when they arrest someone or when something serious comes of the incident. They filled them out in Dante Johnson's case after the fact to document that they were arresting them for robbery. So they collect all these forms and start running data on it. And what they find, to no surprise, is that the street crimes unit is stopping vast numbers of people, even just based on what they are reporting. You know, tens of thousands of people a year. And that there's a vast disproportionate number of young black men being stopped. So lawyers are starting to view the problem as systemic. And what they start to do in response is not just to file these individual suits for damages, like the one I was working with, Dante Johnson. You know, Abner Louima settled for $9 million. Amadou Diallo's family filed a lawsuit. But they start to file class actions, arguing that police are racial profiling. They have plaintiffs, you know, not ones that suffered particularly. They want to pick typical plaintiffs, the type of people who have been stopped and frisked, inconvenienced. They want to find people who have been stopped more than once to show that this is happening over and over again. And they start to file these lawsuits all around the country. The ACLU in particular filed a whole series of these lawsuits as part of a nationwide litigation campaign. The Center for Constitutional Rights in New York filed a lawsuit against the Street Crimes Unit. And that was one that I started working on in law school and kept working on after law school. So all of a sudden the Street Crimes Unit becomes the subject of this lawsuit, not about any one particular incident, but about their overall pattern of targeting young black men. There's another development where in some of these lawsuits, the Justice Department becomes involved. And for some of these cities, Justice Department actually brings the lawsuit in the first instance. And they had new authority to do that based on a statute passed by Congress after the Rodney King riots. Its number is 14141, and it says that the Justice Department can come in and get not just damages, but an injunctive relief. They can actually order a police department to change something that's resulting in lots of unconstitutional acts. They can redress constitutional violations by getting an injunction. And the Justice Department starts entering into settlements, consent decrees, with police department after police department after police department all around the country. So there's this critical mass of public pressure. There's protests. There's all kinds of media coverage. There's celebrities who are stopped and are saying this is racial profiling. And all that is linked now to these statistics that start to emerge about patterns of police behavior, not just individual instances. There's liability to police departments in a few of these cases. You know, Abner Louima gets $9 million. That obviously, you know, gets the police department's attention in terms of their exposure. And these systemic cases start to be brought, including by the Justice Department. So by 2001, there's sort of a nationwide consensus that racial profiling is wrong. So you have, you know, George Bush saying in his campaign that I will not tolerate racial profiling. And you have Ashcroft saying once he's Attorney General, you know, racial profiling is wrong. Everyone agrees racial profiling is wrong. No one agrees what it means or what to do about it. So the first question is, does the law say anything to help explain what racial profiling means? And I want to quickly just say, and you can ask questions about it later, but that the law doesn't offer much help. There are two intersecting constitutional doctrines here. And maybe the intersection is what makes getting relief in these kinds of lawsuits about racial profiling particularly difficult. There's the Fourth Amendment first, which relates to searches, stops. Fourth Amendment says you have to have probable cause for a search, but the police in these cases aren't searching, at least in the first instance. They're just stopping people and patting them down. And the Supreme Court has said you need a lot less to do something like that. All you need is reasonable suspicion. So all the police needed to have to stop Dante Johnson and his friend Kevin was a reasonable suspicion that they were up to no good. Not probable cause to arrest them or to suspect that they're committing any particular crime, but reasonable suspicion. And there's lots of cases saying that police can rely on all sorts of things to have reasonable suspicion. Seeing the bulge, something furtive. You know, for cars, nervous driving, a violation of a traffic rule, and you can do a pretextual stop even if you're looking for drugs. If they violate a traffic law, that's enough to stop them. Even racial incongruity, if they seemed like they were in a neighborhood where weren't a lot of young black kids. They weren't, though. They were in a neighborhood that was majority-minority. But a bulge, that's the kind of bulge that I think looks like a gun. They were kind of furtive, and they were running away. All of that, is reasonable suspicion. And on top of that, if it were true, certainly they would have reasonable suspicion if they thought that these kids matched a profile of an actual crime that was reported. Because police, often have to respond to descriptions of crimes. And when you get a description of a crime, you have to go out and look for people that match that description. And if that description happens to be, two 16-year-old kids who are black and nothing more, then that's all that the police have to go on, and that's what they're looking for. So the Fourth Amendment, very permissive of using race as a factor. And so to say that something is racial profiling, that police used race as one factor, not going to be of much help in terms of getting a legal remedy, because police are allowed to use race as a factor. And we know that in the kinds of examples of stops where courts have found the Fourth Amendment satisfied, we know that race is really the overwhelming factor, the overriding factor. We know in Dante Johnson's case that race was the overriding factor. Doesn't matter. As long as there are other factors, the furtive gesture, whatever it is, the police are going to be able to justify what happens next, the stop and the pat down. So what the lawyers did when they were filing these class actions is they were trying to rely on equal protection theories. So this is where the 14th Amendment comes in. They're relying less on the Fourth Amendment, because the Fourth Amendment is very difficult. They would have to justify, for an entire class of people, they would have to say that in every single one of these cases, the police had no real justification other than race. Police are going to say in the overwhelming amount of these cases, there's some furtive gesture, there's a call on the call that, with a description of a crime. For any one case, the police are going to be able to come up with reasonable suspicion, easy to show reasonable suspicion. So instead, the theory of these class actions was an equal protection theory, that maybe you can't show invidious purpose necessarily, because these officers in Dante Johnson's case, not clear that their purpose was to stop a kid because he was black. Instead, they want to be able to infer purpose from a stark statistical disparity. So they're relying on these statistics. And they're going to say that the street crimes unit, the LAPD, the Maryland state troopers, the New Jersey troopers, whichever police department it is, they were stopping such overwhelming numbers of black motorists, young black men on the street. The statistical pattern was so stark that you should be able to infer that race was a motivating factor in their decisions, and unconstitutionally so. Of course, that raises a different difficult legal collision, because there are these Supreme Court's cases saying that maybe you can show a really stark pattern and then therefore infer that race is a motivating factor, violates the Equal Protection Clause, but under the Fourth Amendment, you're allowed to use race as a motivating factor. So what that means is hard to say, what that intersection means. There was one case where the courts grappled with what that intersection means, and that's the Oneonta case in New York. This is upstate New York. It's a small town. An elderly woman was raped in her home by someone with a knife. All she really saw and knows is that the person was a young black man, had a knife, and cut his hand somehow getting through her window or something like that. And the police then fanned out through this town over the next weeks and basically stopped every black person they could find. They stopped some women too, but focusing on the men, and asked them to show their hands to see whether there was a cut on the hand. Their objective, and they admitted this, was to examine the hands of all the black people in Oneonta. Now, clear that they're relying on race and not much else. They weren't relying on the hand because they were stopping people before they saw the hand. They were looking for men who were black, although they did stop some women. The Second Circuit ends up saying when a class action is filed, similar to the one that I was working on in New York City, Second Circuit says that's fine. They weren't just relying on race. They were relying on the victim's description of a crime, and police are allowed to follow up on a description of a crime. And sure, we know that if the description had been a white man with a cut on his hand, it would have been impractical for them to stop every white person in the city because there would have been tens of thousands. It wasn't that small a town, but there were only a few hundred black residents, so the police thought it was practical to do this. The Second Circuit says that's fine. They weren't stopping people solely based on race, because they're stopping based on race, sex, and kind of age too, because they're looking for young men. And there are a series of other, so that's just the equal protection obstacle to these lawsuits. A series of other obstacles, standing obstacles, difficulty in obtaining injunctive relief against the police department. So there are just all these legal obstacles which would make it seem like no one would ever win one of these things. There's a nationwide litigation campaign going on, which is doomed to failure, waste of everyone's money. It's going to show once and for all that the law can't do anything about racial profiling. So that's what you would have expected to happen. And that's not what happened. And the question that I want to quickly answer in the time that I have left is why something different happened. And something different happened not just before 9/11, but it's still happening after 9/11. After 9/11, polls are saying, you know, people are more, this national public opinion is no longer behind the issue of racial profiling. People are more comfortable with racial profiling because they want to catch the terrorists. And yet, nevertheless, you still see these reforms that were put into place based on these lawsuits in 2000, 2001, still continuing through today. So what seems to have happened is that police began to agree to settlements and consent decrees in these lawsuits, not because they thought they would ever be found liable. For example, in New York, the police were saying all along, you know, our street crimes unit is the best thing that ever happened to us. We're catching a lot of guns. We're stopping, you know, violent attacks from happening. And often we were in high crime neighborhoods, and that's why we're stopping a lot of young black men. And often we're responding to phone calls about robberies and things like that, descriptions of real crimes. So that explains the disparity too. And so you'd expect this to degenerate into a kind of a shouting match, where there are statistics, and the statistics show over-reliance on race, and the police say, no, but we're still not racial profiling. We're using race in all the right ways. We're using race in all the legal ways, ways that are proper under the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, your statistics mean nothing to us, end of story. You'd think that's what would have happened. Instead, what seems to have happened is that this data told an important story, both for civil rights and community groups and also the police. So the academics had long said that race is just a bad proxy for crime, that police are wrong if they think that by focusing on young black men they're going to find more guns, that kind of thing. This data actually showed that. Maybe to everyone's surprise. So the statistics out of New York, out of this anti-gun campaign that was waged by this We Own the Night Street Crimes Unit, showed that in a typical year leading up to 99 when Dante Johnson was shot, only 2.5% of 60,000 people who were stopped actually had some kind of a gun. And that's just in the reported cases. So it's a very, very low hit rate. And police departments are very much driven by data like that. You know, we know that New York has these CompStat meetings where all the chiefs from the boroughs come in and they have to explain their crime data. You know, policing is a very, very data-driven kind of branch of government. And there's a demand for results all the time to bring down the crime numbers. And all of a sudden you have this new data which is showing that this very expensive work that's being done. You know, all these street crimes unit officers being paid overtime to drive around all night and stop everyone in sight. Turns out it's very inefficient. Their profile isn't working. Same thing happened in New Jersey. The data there showed that fewer than 1% of all people stopped, in the reported instances, resulted in arrests. Rhode Island, the state passed a law, like many other states did after 1999. There's a wave of state legislation all around the country requiring data reporting. And they had these quarterly reports, which were showing that as this data began to be collected, police started stopping fewer and fewer minority motorists because they were being watched. And what was more interesting is that as the racial disparity decreased, they started actually finding more and more contraband with more arrests. So, you know, similar data was found in Maryland. So this data starts to tell an interesting story. Another part of the story is that there's a community perception from this data. In Maryland, they showed that that race actually was to some degree correlated with drugs, but that the same inefficiency, blacks were far more likely than whites to be innocent in the stops that they were doing. Another problem that departments like New York did is, based on all this data showing that there's a problem with race, they started having a much harder time recruiting and retaining black police officers. That becomes another part of the problem. So, you start having more and more police departments agreeing to collect this data because they're realizing that it's valuable for their own policing purposes to do their work more efficiently. You start having more and more of these Justice Department consent decrees being settled without a fight. And that way they can say, well, you know, we were forced to do this. Justice Department came in, they're telling us to collect this data. You also start to see, and this is maybe even more surprising, that the police are actually cooperating with the Justice Department and with community groups to decide what to do about the data. And that's the part that I think is maybe the most interesting. So the street crimes unit story, I want to just quickly tell the end of the story before I stop. In 2003, you know, after 9/11, you know, after this wave of sympathy for police officers who passed away, you know, in the Twin Towers, after all this change in public opinion over racial profiling, and nevertheless, even given that, you know, that it's not clear that the civil rights group could ever win the lawsuit, a couple things happened. The judge in that lawsuit ordered in discovery that the police department compile data from going up to the present then. You know, not just the data that the attorney general had looked like in 99, but for all the years since then. The judge says the only way that the plaintiffs can prove whether there's a civil rights problem here or not is if you put together data from all these pieces of paper documenting all of your stops. The police department said, oh, no, we'll have to hire officers, pay them overtime, it'll cost millions of dollars. And the judge says, too bad, it's discovery. That's the only way that they can prove their case is using a statistical pattern that's relevant. I'm ordering it. So all of a sudden, the plaintiffs got a big part of their remedy just in discovery. They didn't have to win. The police department has to pay the millions of dollars to collect these numbers. The numbers are collected, and they confirm what the attorney general had found before, that very few of these stops are resulting in any meaningful arrests or in guns being found. And this occurs in an environment when the priorities all of a sudden are shifting. The police department is realizing that it wants to spend a lot more of its money on catching terrorists and justifying the expense of having this whole team of officers parading around the city stopping every young black man in sight when they're not arresting very many of them. All of a sudden the cost-benefit calculus changes. They're realizing that these aggressive police tactics are expensive and that they need the money for other things. So terrorism had an unpredictable effect on the racial profiling debate in New York. You know, far from making it more difficult to reach reform, it actually made it more difficult because all of a sudden the police were thinking, you know, we need to be more efficient about the way they police. And so what they started doing was rather than have teams just canvass whole neighborhoods, they started using crime data to be much more specific. So they would instead target the real crime pattern, you know, a real phone call about a robbery pattern, and actually, you know, have police officers target a street corner where they actually heard something was happening. And they started becoming much more precise about their policing. And they started to find, you know, towards 2003 that this was incredibly effective. And crime rates were continuing to go down in the way that they had in the late 90s. And that this was working better than just having police sort of roaming the Bronx in these unmarked cars. And so what they agreed to do in a settlement in 2003 was to permanently collect this data and audit it and analyze it, see if there's too much disparity, try to explain whether the disparity was justified or not, and they would do that in conjunction with an independent auditor and with the civil rights group. And they would hold these periodic quarterly meetings to explain the data. And all this is very unusual. The idea that police would be constantly vigilant in their use of race and that they would monitor it and that they would use that to evaluate all the time their practices and their policing. You know, race becomes integrated into the day-to-day process of problem-solving in the NYPD. And it's part of their decision of how they police and where they police and what to do. And this is done in conjunction with these civil rights groups that have been suing them for years. And this wasn't unusual just to New York. In a lot of these other cities, rather than sort of fighting in public, saying, you know, you're racist, we're not, we're just stopping people who have guns, groups that were antagonists all of a sudden are joining together to try to interpret this data and work with it. And so and you start to see it expand to other areas. You know, in Philadelphia, women's groups that were saying that police were dropping rape investigations, sexual assault investigations, got brought in to review the files and come up with new policies along with the police department. In New York, the civil rights groups, as part of the settlement, redesigned the training that the police department used. The same thing happened in L.A. and in New Jersey. You know, these decrees involve collecting data going forward in the future, meeting to discuss what to do with that data, changing training and changing police policies in light of the data. And so, you know, I think this evolution is very interesting. It becomes not just about race, but about monitoring race, collecting data about it, and then using that to reevaluate things that seemed unrelated. Policies, the way that police decide what neighborhoods to police and what crimes to go after. Training, monitoring police officers for misconduct. That's another thing that they used with this data. They would flag problem officers if it seemed like time after time there were complaints about a particular officer. They would have these sort of early warning programs put into place so that red flags would go off if there were reports over and over again about a particular officer. And then most surprising at all, there's collaboration. And who would have expected that there'd be collaboration between community groups and the police over race? You know, not the kind of thing that anyone, I think, would have imagined in 1998, 1999, after the Turnpike shooting, after the Diallo shooting. So, I think this is an interesting story about how a civil rights movement changed, about how police problem solving itself changed, and how there is all of a sudden there was collaboration around an issue where you would expect animosity and distrust, and where there had been animosity and distrust. So, I think all this whole movement says interesting things about police and their openness to change, but also the circumstances where pressure can lead to something more constructive, even in situations where lawsuits seemed like they were doomed to fail because of the underlying law. So I think I've gone on long enough, but hopefully I've given you a picture of kind of a sweeping picture, starting from Dante Johnson's case coming through today, of how these remedies changed over time.